May it please the Court, Mary Petras on behalf of Mark Bundy. Mr. Bundy's circumstance is essentially the same as Mr. Berry's circumstance. It was a little more explicit in Mr. Bundy's agreement that his stipulated sentence was based on the guideline range. The plea agreement specifically said that it was based on the guideline range. The district court, in fact, in denying Mr. Bundy's motion to reduce his sentence, said that the parties came up with the number based on the guideline range, and that guideline range has now been reduced. So Mr. Bundy squarely fits within the category of defendants who should be entitled to a sentence reduction.
He has a ripeness problem, though, right? I mean, because the relief that he's seeking has already been granted in terms of his time of imprisonment, right?
Right.
Your argument is it's now the length of supervised release, right?
Correct.
And is this the right time to challenge the length of supervised release?
It is the right time.
Why?
Because otherwise, when we move before the district court to terminate his supervision early, the district court is, we will be deprived of the factor, which the guideline says is a factor in determining whether or not to terminate a supervision early. The court can consider whether or not there was a term of imprisonment that was served and could not be reduced because it had already been served, but otherwise would have been able to be reduced under 3582.
Yeah, why couldn't the district court? Well, you mean because it's bound by its decision now?
Because if you send it back to the district court without making a finding that the court was wrong in finding that he was not eligible for the sentence reduction, then the court will say that.
Suppose we think the case is moot and we apply our normal rule and vacate the district court's decision. Doesn't that protect you completely?
I suppose.
Case becomes moot on appeal, we usually vacate the district court's decision.
Arguably, but if the
court that's what we usually do. Doesn't that fully protect you?
I don't think so.
Let me tell you why I think it does, and you can tell me why it's wrong, okay? Then next fall, when he becomes eligible for a 3583, he files his 3583 motion at that point, right?
Yes.
And then the district court will have to decide whether, under the circumstances of this case, he's even eligible. And if he is, then you can argue your 3582 issue, right?
I guess it's a timing issue for Mr. Bundy, because if the court does that and issues a decision in Berry that does not clearly state to the district court that Mr. Bundy would have been eligible for a sentence reduction, then we're faced with the problem of going back down, filing our motion, having the court perhaps deny it and say that this isn't
in better shape. If we rule for Berry, then you're in great shape when you go back to the district court under 3583, right?
I guess it would depend on the opinion. I would prefer certainly to have.
But even if we don't, and we vacate the district court's decision, you're back. It seems to me you haven't lost anything, and
we've lost time.
The problem is there's nothing we can do now. There's nothing we can do or the district court can do now that affects your defendant at all.
The problem in the prejudice to Mr. Bundy is the timing issue, because if we go back down without a decision and only have a decision in Berry, and the district court says, no, you know what, in this particular case, I think I'm right, and this wasn't based on the guideline range, then we have to appeal it again.
Right, exactly.
Right, but by this time, Mr. Bundy could be off supervision and not only have been deprived of the opportunity to get his incarceration reduced, but it will deprive him of the opportunity to get his supervised release reduced.
Well, but wait a minute. If he goes back, it's next October, he will have completed 1 year, right, of supervised relief? Is that right?
I believe so.
Well, it must be, because he's not eligible until 1 year is up, right?
Okay.
So let's just, and you lose and you appeal, right? It would come back up here in time for the whole question to be resolved.
It would come back up in time to get some reduction. It wouldn't come back up here in time to get all of the reduction that he could possibly get. And for a defendant who submitted his motion and appealed it timely and has the issue presented before the court, to then be told that you need to go back down, make the argument again, perhaps lose again, come back up, and then be deprived not only of the reduction in the time, but be deprived of reduction, further reduction in the supervised release, it demonstrates it's not moot. He has a definite stake in the court's decision here, because his stake is the ability to go before the district court and say, look, you could have reduced my sentence, and you made a mistake, and you didn't. That's a very powerful argument in trying to get off a term of supervised release, and it would be depriving him of that. He has a significant stake in that. And if the court wants, I could also address the government's argument that he cannot terminate early his term of supervised release because it was a mandatory term of supervised release. The government had argued in its brief that once it's a mandatory term of supervised release, 3583E does not apply. But as the court in Spinelli found, it does apply. I know that the statute's been amended since then, but it didn't amend it to take away the defendant's right to terminate early. And the only courts that I've found that have addressed the issue of whether or not you can terminate early as term of supervised release that was, when imposed, a mandatory term, have found that the court does still retain that right to terminate early.
You're saying that the statutory amendment does not go as far as the government's brief says it does?
It does not. It wasn't even for the purpose that the government submits that it was for. The statute was amended to clarify that the mandatory terms of supervised release were to be imposed regardless of what the other recommended terms of supervised release were. There were cases in which people were challenging the fact that they were receiving mandatory terms that exceeded the recommended amounts in 3583. But it did not take away the court's right and jurisdiction to terminate early under 3583E.
So your argument then for why this case is not moot is that it's not moot because if we don't decide it now, the defendant runs the risk of not being able to get his claim for reduced supervisory release resolved in time to have a meaningful impact.
That's part of the prejudice, because time is ticking away. His ability to reduce his sentence is ticking away. But my argument for why it's not moot is his stake in the issue is his ability to make this argument before the district court in a timely fashion.
Yeah, but do you know of any case that says that a case is protected from mootness because without it, the party would lack a legal argument to make in a case?
I don't think that this is much different than McCoy. I know that in McCoy...
Well, McCoy was a direct appeal, wasn't it?
McCoy was a direct
appeal. Yeah, it's a totally different situation, isn't it?
I don't think so, because the only thing that remanding in McCoy did was give McCoy the opportunity to argue for a shorter term of supervised release. And that's essentially all we're asking for, is an opportunity
to
argue.
But the point is, he could have done it on remand. The case was not moot. He could have made that argument. In other words, he would have won on appeal, had the legal right to argue for a reduced supervised relief on remand. But that's not the case here. If we were to decide this in your favor and decide it next week, for example, nothing would happen until, A, the defendant filed his motion under 3583. That's right, number one. And number two, the district court decided that he was even eligible for a 3583 reduction. Both of those would have to happen before you ever got back to the 3582 issue.
I do understand that we have to file the motion that would get us back to the issue, but it doesn't change the stake that he has in the outcome in being able to do that with the argument that the court was wrong on not reducing his term of incarceration.
All right. All right. We hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sarah Chasson on behalf of the United States. We would ask that the court dismiss Mr. Bundy's appeal as moot. This court cannot grant Mr. Bundy any effectual relief whatsoever. As you had pointed out, Judge Tatel, a ruling in this court has no effect on what is going to happen in the district court beyond the theoretical possibility that an argument that is one of at least five or six that the appellant might make, could perhaps be strengthened. No case has held that a case or controversy sufficient for this court to retain jurisdiction is created by such a theoretical possibility. It's entirely speculative. for Mr. Bundy to say to this court, I need a ruling in order to obtain relief from the district court. He can file his motion as of the end of September of 2010. And in that motion, he can make every single argument that he could make with an opinion from this court to Judge Lamberth. He can argue that his sentence was too high. He can argue that all of the 3553A factors really support the right to have his term of supervised release reduced. He can argue that he is a different man from the person who accrued violations in prison and should be given a chance to rehabilitate himself. All of those arguments are available to him regardless of whether the court issues a ruling on the merits of his appeal. And for that reason, we would ask that the court dismiss his appeal as moot.
All right. Any questions?
I would like to just address one point that I believe Ms. Petras sort of incorporated by reference in her argument as to the intent of the parties that he be given a guideline sentence. This is really going to be entirely unworkable to figure out whether the guidelines actually were the negotiating basis of the C1C agreement.
Well, in his plea agreement, though, this is JA-21.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's pretty explicit.
Yes, it is. But what it also doesn't say is what guidelines might or might not have applied and how they arrived at that particular number within that guideline range.
I know, we don't want to re-argue the barrier.
I understand. I just wanted to point out that...
Yes.
I just wanted
but it wouldn't be unworkable. But it wouldn't be unworkable if we adopted the defendant's view, which is that if it is in fact within the guidelines, then it's based on the guidelines.
It's going to make Judge Rogers mad at me because it will be re-arguing.
But that's okay. I asked the question. She'll get mad at me. She'll get mad at me.
It comes back to the government's whole view of that. Thank you, Your Honor.
But it's not because it's unworkable, right? It's just your view is that this is basically a C issue, not a 3580.
Our first line is absolutely that it's a C issue. But as a predicate point, it is going to become unworkable. I mean, we had Ms. Petras talking about how we could just have a hearing with the prosecutor and we could have, you know, other people come in with their
notes. Well, she only answered that because she was answering my question. I mean, her preferred position is, look, she looks at this, she said, this is a guideline sentence. You just look at it. So
the government's view is it's a Rule 11 sentence.
All right, fine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Counsel for appellant, anything further?
I'd say in response to the unworkable, I mean, the parties know why they came up to a number. These aren't a mystery, and the guidelines aren't a mystery, and how pleas are negotiated are not a mystery, and I don't think the court should ignore the reality of that.
Courts figure those things out all the time, don't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.